good Monday and welcome to the My Ag Life Daily News Report. I'm your host, Lori Boyer. On the show here today, Taylor Charlstrom will have a report about winter recharge in almonds, and I'll bring you national and regional agricultural news, beginning with regional ag news right after this.
There's giant potential sleeping in your soil. Under drought conditions, it's never been more important to wake it up. Phycoterra, a superior soil microbial food, activates the native microbes responsible for your soil's health and water-holding capacity. Adding Phycoterra to your crop increases water retention up to 10% and optimizes crop nutrient availability. Plus, it delivers excellent mixability and application flexibility, making it easy to add to your existing crop input strategy. Visit Phycoterra.com to learn how you can wake up your soil's giant potential with Phycoterra.
Following the principles of integrated pest management, agricultural officials use male attractant technique as a mainstay of the eradication effort for this invasive species. This approach has successfully eliminated dozens of fruit fly infestations in California. Trained workers squirt a small patch of fruit fly attractant mixed with a very small dose of an organic pesticide approximately 8 to 10 feet off the ground on street trees and similar surfaces. Male fruit flies are attracted to the mixture and perish after consuming it. The male attractant treatment program is being carried out in an area that extends 1.5 miles from each site where the oriental fruit flies were trapped. While fruit flies and other invasive species that threaten California's crops and natural environment are sometimes detected in agricultural areas, the vast majority are found in urban and suburban communities. The most common pathway for these pests to enter the state is by hitchhiking in fruits and vegetables brought back illegally by travelers as they return from infested regions of the world or from packages of homegrown produce from other countries sent to California. Help protect California's agricultural and natural resources. They ask that you please don't pack a pest when traveling or mailing packages. The oriental fruit fly is widespread throughout much of the mainland of southern Asia and neighboring islands, including Sri Lanka and Taiwan, and is also known to target over 230 different fruit, vegetable, and plant commodities. Important California crops at risk include pome, stone fruits, citrus, dates, avocados, and many vegetables, particularly tomatoes and peppers. Damage occurs when the female fruit fly lays her eggs inside the fruit. The eggs hatch into maggots, which tunnel through the flesh of the fruit, making it unfit for consumption. According to the LA Times, California regulators have begun curtailing the water rights of many farms and irrigation districts along the Sacramento River, forcing growers to stop diverting water from the river and its tributaries. The order, which took effect last week, puts a hold on about 5,800 water rights across the Sacramento and San Joaquin River's watersheds, reflecting the severity of California's extreme drought. Together with a similar order in June, the State Water Resources Control Board now has curtailed just under 10,000 water rights this year in the Sacramento and San Joaquin watersheds, more than half of the nearly 16,700 existing rights. The San Joaquin Valley is about a week into its table grape harvest, and the region is poised to serve the retailers' organic grape needs well into the fall. They started harvesting organic reds from the San Joaquin Valley a week ago and began organic greens just recently as well, according to John Harley, Vice President of Sales and Marketing for Anthony Vineyards in Bakersfield. He says within the next 2 weeks, most San Joaquin Valley shippers will have fruit, making that region once again the center of the grape deal. He noted that Mexico has had its day in the sun, but its July volumes did not materialize. He says every year the Mexican grape industry says it will have big supplies through July, but that never happens. They recently lowered their estimate by 5 million boxes, and he says he doesn't think they are going to reach that. Early in the spring, producers from Mexico did estimate a record crop approaching 25 million boxes, with most of it slated to be shipped during the 6 to 8 week period from mid-May to mid-July. California growers were concerned that the San Joaquin Valley production might get underway amidst a glut of grapes and low prices. Harley said that is not the case, as the early July organic table grape market was in the high 20s, which he called a good market, adding he expects the pricing on organic crops to hold for the next 2 to 3 weeks, then there should be a small downward adjustment and then maybe another one a couple weeks later. There will be promotable volumes of California organic red and green grapes from late July through the fall. He says organic black grapes will be a little spottier coming in and out of production. According to OrganicProduceNetwork.com, Organic seedless watermelons are available as Bakersfield, California crops have started up with excellent quality. There will be a small Georgia deal this season as well, and overall quality should be excellent. Organic mini watermelons are tight as regions are gapping. Mexico and Southern California harvests have finished, and new fields are just starting. Quality has been excellent, and more availability is expected to come as the month progresses. Organic cantaloupes are in season with promotable pricing and excellent quality. Organic honeydew are also in season from the USA. Organic hammy and Galia melons continue, and there's still some Mexican organic honeydews at promotable pricing. And in the berry category, organic strawberries remain promotable out of Watsonville. Quality has been excellent and supplies remain plentiful. New Jersey organic blackberries are in season, and while quality has been nice, volume will be light with a short season. California organic blackberry harvests are in transition and volume is very limited. Organic raspberries will be promotable out of California as quality has been excellent and supplies are strong. Organic blueberries are going to be extremely tight for early July. New Jersey harvests are limited and California crops finished weeks earlier than planned due to hot temperatures. The University of California, Davis is building a special greenhouse to protect the future of America's wine grape industry. Foundation Plant Services provides virus-tested grapevine plant material to nurseries, which are then sold to vineyards.
We provide plant material to other states in the East Coast and also in Washington, Oregon, and the Midwest.
That is director of the FPS, Meher Rawini. He says the new 14,000 square foot, $5 million clean greenhouse is designed to keep insects and diseases out.
It's very important that we provide the growers with a source of clean plant material, because for plant viruses or viruses in general, there is no cure. So we want to make sure that tested and clean certified plant material is what all the growers start to thrive to.
Red blotch disease has been detected in the two traditional outdoor fields at UC Davis, spreading at a troubling rate. Researchers are propagating material from healthy plants to eventually move into the new greenhouse, which is scheduled to open by the end of 2023. He noted that a second greenhouse is also planned.
Do you know the nutrient use efficiency people? Yes, I'm talking about the folks at Verdesian Life Sciences that deliver crop insights and solutions so California crops grow to their full potential. From micros with a proprietary delivery system to solutions that help improve the uptake and assimilation of applied nutrients. Visit VLSCI.com to learn more about Verdesian solutions or to connect with a local representative right here in California.
California signed the Sustainable Groundwater Management Act into law in 2014. SGMA requires groundwater-dependent regions to halt overdraft and develops plans to reach an annual balance of pumping and recharge. Groundwater aquifers can be recharged by flooding agricultural fields when fallow, but this has not been an option for perennial crops such as fruit and nut trees. While flooding these crops might be possible during the dormant season, it isn't known what impact flooding might have on tree root systems, health, and yield. That's why University of California researchers partnered with the Almond Board to find out just that. They followed root production, tree water status, and yield in two almond orchards in Northern California for 2 years to test the impact of applying captured winter water runoff for groundwater recharge purposes on tree performance.
Most of the past research had actually focused on the opposite treatment, meaning how would almond trees fare without any winter irrigation? So Ken Shackle, one of the collaborators on this project, he was actually interested in seeing, would we be able to go without any additional winter irrigation if we have a drought winter? And then we just added a second treatment basically to the study, which was doing the opposite, which is applying about 2 feet of water per acre in the winter and see if that had any negative effects. So trying to understand, you know, how are trees adapting to drought winters or dry winters, as well as, you know, intentional recharge for groundwater replenishment.
That was Helen Dahlke, a researcher with UC Davis. She said that results showed more than 90% of the water applied to sandy soil and 80% of the water applied to loamy soil percolated past the root zone, with no measured adverse effects on tree water status, canopy development, or yield. Groundwater recharge also did not negatively affect new root production and tended to extend root lifespan, according to Dahlke. Based upon these data, applying additional water in late December and January is not likely to have negative impacts on almond orchards in moderately drained to well-drained soils. However, the practice is not recommended for everyone, especially those with unoptimal soil types.
We had one site near Orland in the Sacramento Valley, Northern California, and that soil had a hard pan in the profile. We were not even able to recharge 20 inches or 24 inches of water as we had planned. We only got about 5 inches into the soil. And most of the applied water was actually trying to become surface runoff and runoff to the neighboring plot. So that one clearly showed a limitation that if you have a soil that has a low infiltration rate or some sort of feature in the soil profile that prevents deep percolation, it is not a good candidate to do a recharge, because the goal of the recharge is to get lots of water into the ground, not to create a waterlogged root zone where we have potential issues with oxygen. So often over time, there's a depletion in oxygen in the root zone, which can have negative effects on root health and root production. But it's also potentially increasing the risk that trees are toppling over if you have high wind events. We did not have any issues actually with losing trees to stormy conditions. But we, from our farm advisors, we have received reports that this sometimes can be an issue on some fields.
For growers that are interested in recharge during the dormant season, there are a couple tools provided by the University of California that allow them to test their soil for optimal conditions.
We, for example, have developed a little decision support tool that's called the Soil Agricultural Groundwater Banking Index, or short SAGBI. It is a tool that ranks soil suitability for groundwater recharge and particularly looks for, characteristics such as, is there a hard pan or has the hard pan been removed by deep ripping, or are there any soil layers in the profile that have a low hydraulic conductivity that would really slow down the percolation of the water through the profile. So that is always a first check that we use, that we look at a site and we consult the SAGBI index and see what the rankings are. Rankings vary between excellent, which is typically in green colors on the map, and very poor, which is typically in red colors. And so far, we've seen that soils that are either moderately good, very good, or excellent are pretty good candidates for groundwater recharge. But I always recommend doing a site-specific analysis. This could be done by drilling a couple soil cores with a hand auger. But most growers actually do know their sites pretty well just from irrigating them and often have an understanding of how quickly the water infiltrates when they irrigate. And that is often a good indication as well.
While the research has shown the benefits that a practice like this can provide, recharging in the dormant season is not recommended for all growers in the state by University of California or the Almond Board.
If you don't really have a soil that can infiltrate water well, we would not recommend it, because almonds are one of those trees that are actually blooming and leafing out very early in the spring. So typically around Valentine's Day or, February 15th, 14th, we see the bloom of almond trees. So meaning as the tree gets active, we actually don't want to create waterlogged conditions in the root zone, because it can have adverse effects on nutrient and water uptake that the tree wants to do at that time. But it might be a practice for growers that have suitable soils, that have a good connection to surface water supply systems, that might still have flood irrigation systems in their orchard where they can apply large amounts of water onto an orchard. It particularly might be a solution in those rare wet years when other managed aquifer recharge technologies, such as infiltration basins, for example, at full capacity, And when we're looking for additional sites to spread water to intentionally recharge groundwater. So it can be a once in a while event that can definitely help with the overall water budget in California.
This is Taylor Charlstrom reporting for My Ag Life.
Sponsored by the California Walnut Board and Commission, delivering value to growers and handlers with advocacy, research programs, and walnut promotions. Doing more together.
The U.S. Department of Agriculture underscored the importance of agricultural research and development at the G20 meeting of agricultural chief scientists last week. Research and development is critical in tackling the challenges of global food security and climate change, according to USDA, which called on G20 members to support the Agriculture Innovation Mission for Climate. USDA's chief scientist, Dr. Shavonda Jacobs-Young, led the U.S. delegation to the meeting, where agricultural science leaders from around the world convened to discuss global challenges facing agriculture and to align both national and global research and development priorities. Jacobs-Young says ambitious investment in climate-smart agriculture and food systems innovation will help create a surge of solutions. Jacobs-Young also highlighted the United States' leadership role in a global coalition for sustainable productivity growth, as well as the United States' continued focus on innovative technologies and approaches to reduce food loss and waste in the agricultural supply chain. The United States and Canada have announced a memorandum of understanding to settle a dispute on trade of solar products under the United States-Mexico-Canada Agreement. The MOU promotes greater North American solar supply integration and reaffirms both countries' commitment to prohibit imports of solar products produced in whole or in part with forced or compulsory labor, according to the U.S. Trade Representative's office. The MOU also contains a mechanism to ensure that solar product imports from Canada do not undermine the existing U.S. safeguard measure on imports of solar products. Ambassador Catherine Tai says reaching this settlement with Canada will promote greater deployment of solar energy in the United States using products from one of our closest allies. The U.S. imposed a solar safeguard measure during the Trump administration. This year, a USMCA panel issued its report finding that the prior administration's decision to include imports from Canada in the solar safeguard measure was inconsistent with certain USMCA rules. USDA's Economic Research Service reports behavior changes during the pandemic exacerbated an already existing adult obesity epidemic. As the COVID-19 pandemic unfolded in 2020, studies using limited online surveys found evidence of weight gain among adults. However, because the pandemic surveys did not represent the overall U.S. adult population, findings derived from them did not fully show how much obesity rates changed for adults during the pandemic. The study found that compared with a pre-pandemic baseline period, adult obesity prevalence was 3% higher over the period from March 13th of 2020 to March 18th of 2021, the first year of COVID-19 pandemic. Findings also showed statistically significant changes in each of the four obesity-related behaviors during the COVID-19 pandemic. Participation in exercise rose 4.4%. People slept 1.5% longer. Meanwhile, the number of days in the period of a month in which alcohol was consumed was 2.7% higher, and cigarette smoking dropped by 4%. And when it comes to successful dairy operations, one dairy extension expert notes some common characteristics. USDA Ag News reporter Rod Bain.
How would one define a successful dairy farm? University of Minnesota Extension's Jim Sulfur acknowledges.
Probably changes, and it probably is really variable from farm to farm. A lot of that really should be based on the farmer's goals.
Whether the goals are family, financial, or business oriented. Yet regardless of goals, Sulfur notes some common characteristics among successful dairy growers.
You can almost kind of lump them into two broad categories, kind of big picture items, business items, and then there's obviously you need to have a lot of good success production skills.
And he says it starts with producers having what he calls an attitude of gratitude.
And they're so gracious. If I come out, they'll be thankful. They'll thank the agribusiness people that are out there as we meet. And they just go out of their way. And they're also very thankful for the customers that they have.
Like most business owners, Passion for work is a common characteristic for successful dairy operators.
Most of these successful farmers really have pretty flexible business plans, and they think about long and short range goals. So they tend to try to be as nimble as they can. And that's forward looking.
After developing an action plan to reach stated goals for the success of their dairy farm,
annually they'll get together with their group of trusted advisors and say, this is how we did this year based on our goals. What do you guys see coming down the road? This is what we think. This is where our business is going. So in the next year, we're going to have these plans. The next 5 years, we're going to have these plans. Tell us what you think. Tell us if you think we're on track.
Likewise, when it comes to hiring employees within the operation,
really good farmers say, what are my weaknesses? And I'm going to hire a team of people around me that are different than I am, with a really different set of skill sets and a different mindset. And I think that's really beneficial.
Sulfur adds, successful dairy farmers tend to prioritize organization, keep good records, and are proactive about getting work done on time. Also,
they really kind of have this cow sense. They have a unique ability to spot cows before she's sick.
And along those lines, successful dairy operators assure their cows are healthy and comfortable, and they know how to care for special need animals.
Consistently put up high quality forage.
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
JCS Marketing is your number one way to connect with the ag industry. Through print magazines, digital media, podcast, and live and virtual events, JCS Marketing has the reach to inform, educate, and influence growers in the Western United States.
Everywhere you go, you see West Coast Nut Magazine on every one of my customers' tables. So that tells you everything. It's there, so they're reading it.
Our My Ag Life platform includes podcast interviews and digital articles for busy professionals on the go. Our live events, continuing education webinars, and virtual conferences help growers connect with leading researchers and industry leaders. Let JCS Marketing help you connect.
Peter Schneider doesn't grow pistachios or process almonds or market walnuts. But as president of a mid-sized trucking company, Schneider is an essential part of California's tree nut industry. Schneider is head of TGS Transportation and its sister company, TGS Logistics. His Fresno-based drayage operation transports more than 500 million pounds of almonds, pistachios, and walnuts every year to the ports of Oakland, Los Angeles, and Long Beach. If you add in the other ag products his company hauls, like powdered milk, raisins, and seed, TGS runs as many as 150 trucks a day to those ports. That means Schneider is wrestling with many of the same challenges other ag-related businesses are, from soaring fuel, labor, and equipment costs, to increasing regulations, to maybe the biggest issue of all, port and supply chain problems. When I asked Schneider how his costs have risen in the last year or two, here's what he said.
That's a loaded question. All of our larger costs have gone up. So we all are feeling the pinch at the pump right now. And in the last 19 months, the price of diesel has gone up about 120%. So from $3.20 a gallon to now we're paying $6.80 a gallon for diesel. I mean, that's just a massive number. And that usually is our second largest cost. Our largest cost is labor costs. But right now, fuel is actually jumped over labor costs. Our labor costs have gone up about 35% for our company drivers. So the wage per hour has gone from $18, $19 an hour to $20, $25 an hour in the Central Valley. In LA, in the Bay Area, it's gone from $24, $25 an hour to $32, $33 an hour. So these drivers are making very good money. Our independent contractors' costs have gone up 30, 35% also.
Schneider added that his office staff costs have also increased by $4 to $5 an hour. Sometimes that's not even enough to find and keep good office employees. And when I asked him about other major challenges, Schneider told me this.
How many hours do you have? So from a trucking point of view in California, we've been regulated so much over the last 15 years, and we're getting ready for another bout of regulation through CARB, which is the California Air Resource Board. They have put in a couple of regulations in the early 2000s mandating that we run cleaner trucks. Well, some time has passed, and now a new regulation is coming in effective January 1st to make it that all trucks have to be 2010 and newer. As an industry, I'll just say in LA Long Beach, there's about 5,000 or 6,000 trucks out of 18,000 that call the port every day that will be exempt, that will not be allowed to go in starting in January. And there's about, I don't know, maybe 800 to 1,000 in the Port of Oakland out of 3,000, 4,000 trucks. So 20, 25% of the trucks will be going away at the end of this year because they're too old, and the mandate is a 2010 engine truck and newer. So the trucks you see behind me, those are 2020s. The rest of my fleet are 2017s. You know, we have newer trucks. My company, I'm going to lose between 5 and 15% of my fleet, probably not more than that. And or already some of them are getting newer trucks. But here, part of the problem with COVID is the production and manufacturing of trucks is almost non-existent. It's about a year to 18 months wait to get a new truck. I can't even order a new truck right now because they're not taking a PO for them because they're so backlogged. So in order for the industry to meet the needs, you have to buy a used truck. And honestly, a used truck that's 2 or 3 years old is more expensive than a new truck because of supply and demand.
So what kind of money are we talking about, used versus new?
So the trucks behind me, I paid about $140,000, $150,000 for. Today, those are $200,000 trucks, just 1, 2 years later. A used truck that's got 200,000 or 300,000 miles is $200,000 as well.
And that's just one regulation. I'm assuming there are others that really are challenging you.
Yeah, correct. So in the industry, international shipping, what we face as a whole industry is a lot of challenges to do our job every day because we've been hit hard with just so many added costs, specifically for the exporter. In our industry, they've paid 30, 40, 50% more than they did a year and a half ago. And not just the labor costs that I've had to pass on, but extra costs for storing containers on a chassis, which is an extra cost per day, in a yard, which is an extra cost per day, because the vessel timing to turn in the export order got screwed up. And then their booking got canceled. And so now they have a load sitting. They have to rebook it on another vessel a week later, 2 weeks later. So things were a lot worse a year ago. They've kind of calmed down because we've all worked together in the supply chain to become more cohesive, as cohesive as we can be, given how arduous things really are. But there's still a lot of work to be done.
Schneider serves on several transportation industry boards and committees, including the Federal Maritime Commission, the Harbor Trucking Association, the Ag Transportation Coalition, the Intermodal Association of North America, and the Port Efficiency Task Force of the Port of Oakland. Those roles enable Schneider to use his knowledge and experience to help solve the transportation problems that have plagued California ag exporters since COVID sent shipping into a tailspin. Little by little, Schneider has seen some progress.
I do talk a lot about the problems and stuff in the industry, but I also like to present some of the solutions as well. And hopefully one of the solutions is the new OSRA bill, the Ocean Shipping Reform Act, that will make the steamship lines and the marine terminal operators more accountable. But on top of that, California is coming out with a new law, and it should be hopefully passed this year. It's called AB 2406. And it's very similar to the OSRA federal act, but it's just for California, And it is more pointed at the steamship lines and marine terminal operators. And ag is very much behind this, as well as CTA, California Trucking Association, to put the accountability squarely, more defined, on the steamship line and terminals, so that when one thing is not met, they are held responsible.
As we wrapped up our late June interview, Schneider urged TreeNet shippers to secure their shipment bookings as early as possible. And he added a second message for producers, processors, and shippers to help solve the port problems.
They need to be loud. They need to work with WAPA and Almond Alliance and whatever association they're affiliated with. And if they're not getting what they want, they need to work with another one. There's some that have been louder than others. All the way up to the AGTC, which is kind of the national ag transportation, you know, coalition. They need to be vocal, not just with their association, but they need to be vocal with the ports that they work with.
That will wrap up today's show. You've been listening to the My Ag Life Daily News Report. I'm Lori Boyer. From all of us here at the JCS Marketing Team, thank you for listening.